Gary Andrews, as our favorite playwright once said, Lord, what fools you mortals be. And here you are directing Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, not for the first time, not for the third, for the fifth time. How many times is this for you?
Yeah, this is the fifth time. This is my fifth dream.
Have you learned nothing, my friend?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. I'm Austin Titchener, co-artistic director of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, now in its 18th year, number 915, Dreaming Multiple Dreams. Artist and illustrator Gary Andrews, who so beautifully illustrated Daisy the Littlest Zombie, has just opened his production of A Midsummer Night's Dream for the Archway Theatre in England, and it only runs for two more weekends, closing on June 30th, 2024. This is the fifth production of Midsummer that Gary's directed, but as we'll hear, it's easily the eighth or tenth production he's worked on or been in. So I was fascinated to hear how Shakespeare's arguably most popular comedy speaks to him differently every time.
I was Puck in another version that I didn't direct. I've been Puck three times, twice in ones that I've directed, once by choice and once having to step in, and once for somebody else that was a kind of fetishy, leathery, very kind of sort of funky version, which was a lot of fun. So yeah, there's been a few. I've done a steampunk one, I've done a 1920s one, I've done a Regency one, you know, so yeah, and that's fun, always trying to find a new take on it.
Well, I was going to say, I'm glad that that's what you do. You're not just doing the same dream every time. When you come to it, you're in a different place. You've got different actors, right? And does the play really speak to you differently each time you approach it?
Every single time. I'm amazed, actually, with a play that I know so well and that everybody knows so well, how many new things you mine in it each time just by having different people playing the roles, different ages playing the roles, and a different setting. It's an open air. It's my second open air one. We did an open air one a couple of years ago, and I set it with Regency humans and kind of almost high fantasy fairies, you know, lots of leather armor and antlers and stuff like that, and it was really good fun.
Epic, this yeah.
Yeah, it was very cool, very cool. And I had lots of fairies and Oberon had goblins and everything, you know. This one we have less. We've got the standard four fairies and then just Puck with Oberon. But we are I used sort of Arthur Rackham as a starting point this time around, because I've got an original illustrated Arthur Rackham dream and I love it. It's beautiful. Oh. So I went for the Victorian, although he sets it in Greece. Because he's Victorian, I set it in late Victorian for the humans, which gives you that buttoned-up society, which works very well for the whole Theseus and Aegeus kind of world.
Victorian and England, you mean?
Exactly, Victorian England. I mean, you know, it says Greece, but it's not Greece.
No,
England. And then for the fairies, I've set them in kind of Elizabethan, but as if they have never changed since they first put them on. So I've got very tatty, grubby, dirty Elizabethan fairies that are mostly sort of browns and greens, except for Oberon, who's in sort of red velvet and black. You know, he's not as grubby as the rest because dirt falls off Oberon. Plus he's wearing one of my nice jackets, they want to dirty it. So that's my excuse. But yeah, so you've got this nice contrast between this sort of grubby fairy world and this very buttoned up, you know, Victorian society. And again, with the ages, it's like last time I directed it, my lovers were all sort of in their 20s and young and sort of bouncy. And this one, my Hermia is quite young, but the others are all sort of 30s. And in fact, my Demetrius is 40-something. I'm feeding that into their sort of their subtext, if you like, is that, you know, Demetrius, you know, used to love Helena, who is that bit older sort of thing. We're saying that Helena was possibly a senior at school when Hermia was a junior, but she would have had that junior crush, you know, so they would be friends. Lysander possibly was friends with maybe Hermia's older brother, and it's that classic thing of the little sister that suddenly grew up, and so he's suddenly gone, oh, hello, you know, and and Demetrius, they're all part of like the diplomatic corps, and he sees the political advantage of marrying Aegeus's daughter, you know, and a 20-year age gap is very normal in the Victorian society. So we're playing that kind of vibe with them.
I just saw A Tempest, and I came out of it going, that production feels like the director lost a bet and had and was assigned to direct this play, because I couldn't discern a point of view in the production. Do you ask yourself every time you set out to do it, and I assume it gets programmed because it's a very popular play, ask yourself the question every time, why this play, why now? What makes the dream speak to the audience who's going to see it in 2024?
Yeah, I mean, to an extent. I mean, I think I don't over-politicize, because the reason we're doing this one is it's a new venture in my little theatre I do a lot of stuff with, and we do 10 shows a year indoors. But this is one we're teaming up with some beautiful gardens near us, and it's the first time this theatre is doing an outdoor Shakespeare with these particular gardens, which are very beautiful. So we said, it's got to be the dream. It pulls people in. It's just the perfect starter play for this new venture. And a beautiful setting. And you know, it made sense from a business plan, if you like, to do the dream. Right? So you go, right, now we're doing the dream. So what am I going to get out of doing the dream this time? What am I going to do to make a difference? So I don't have an agenda going in. I have the setting that I wanted to do the Victorian, the Arthur Rackham thing spoke to me. But then once I cast it, then I say, right, who have I got? What can this cast bring to it? And so we bring this whole kind of the political side of it with Demetrius and Lysandra and blah, blah, blah. We decided, because it's the late Victorian thing, the expansionism of the British Empire, so the whole Hippolyta thing works very well with that. But it's not that kind of, we haven't gone down the kind of heavy route with that. We've made her, although she's a leader of somewhere that has been beaten in war, Theseus is actually quite apologetic, because she's quite strong. So yeah.
We better be apologetic. Yeah,
exactly. So
and
that
there's,
opening.
There's comedy Aegeus, there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. When Aegeus says either to this man or to her death, you know, Hippolyta is like, what? And then he holds up a little book of rules according to our law and gives it to Theseus. And Theseus is like, oh, sugar. Goes through the book, and he goes, yes, or she could be a nun, because you think Hippolyta's giving him daggers, and he's trying to find a way out. So he's not going, yes. He's going, oh God, I can't do it. You know, by our law, which by no means I can extenuate. So he's even sort of trying to find excuses. So we've got comedy even out.
Beautiful.
Of that.
That's beautiful. And so active and comic, and not just portentous speechifying by the leader. Oh, brilliant. Chef's kiss.
Hurrah. And then later on, when they come back and find the lovers sleeping, I've given a lot of Theseus's lines to Hippolyta at that point. She says, who are these sleeping? Oh, yeah. She says, he will allow you to get married with us. She says, we're all going to have a multiple wedding. And Theseus is like, yeah, right then. And she takes the lead. And then later on, when Philostrate, or in our version, actually Aegeus, we've conflated it with Philostrate, gives them the list of plays that are going to be on. Instead of being a sort of Theseus monologue, he gives it to her, and she reads out what each one is, and then he excuses it. You know, the riot of the tipsy bacchanals, she sort of looks at him, and he goes, oh, no, that's this, that, and the other. So it becomes a two-way, we balanced it out a bit more with Hippolyta to give her more to do.
Well, and you see, it's a way of showing and dramatizing their growing relationship, because they do end up married, and you sort of want to root for them.
Yeah, and in the opening scene, no, she storms off at the opening scene when he's, you know, doing the bit with Hermia. But then later on, when she says they can get married with us, he takes her hands and kisses her hands, and they go off together, and you see them coming together, you know. So we've played that journey. And also, you know, in the late Victorian time, it was the beginning of where, you know, we had a queen on the throne. So women were powerful, but also in the society, women were just starting to sort of make that emergence that would lead to the suffragettes and everything. So I wanted to sort of just bring that side up with the Victorian setting a bit.
I've only directed it once, like the hack I am.
You're lightweight, you beginner.
I know, and I didn't realize until afterwards that I was nervous about it. I wasn't conscious about it until later that I had been nervous about, oh my God, it's Midsummer Night's Dream. I've got to make it funny. But of course, I reminded myself that I always tell my actors, I'm not worried about making it funny. We can always make it funny. I'm worried about making it grounded. And in making it grounded, it became funny in ways that I had never seen before done in any other dream. Do you find similar moments of comedy that you've never discovered before? And
I do. I mean, comedy between Theseus and Hippolyta, especially in this one. And also, I mean, it varies time to time. I always say in quite a few of the versions that I've gone into, especially after my first one, that I don't try and make the mechanicals funny because they will look after themselves. It's in the writing. And if you push it too hard, it becomes just happy. So you let the comedy look after itself there to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. I concentrate on the lovers and try to make them funny. You can make them dark. You can play the very dark versions. I've seen dark versions. I'm tempted to do a dark one day, maybe. But this was not the time or the place. We want the family audience. We want the fun, the summer afternoon with your picnic. We want a heightened, almost panto-ish feel at times. Yeah. So our lovers are very, very, quite broad in a lot of their comedy. And, you know, Lysander is so over-keen to be with Hermia, but Hermia is actually quite buttoned up. And instead of being a really sweet Hermia, she's actually quite refined, and he's very sort of like frustrated by that, whereas our Helena is all over Demetrius, you know. It's kind of, wow. It's quite funny. So we're playing a lot with that, and with the mechanicals we have gone for that, instead of going for just the idiot vibe, which I'm not that keen on. I've just gone for the super keen, super eager vibe with them all. Bottom, we were developing Bottom to be one of the cuddly Bottoms. You know, there's been a move recently towards, away from the bombastic, towards the cuddly, and I love them. The bridge one, you know, amazing. And yeah. I think there's a lot of mileage in a Bottom who is just so well-meaning.
Yeah,
because all the rest of the mechanicals really worried about him and really worried that he can't be there and that he would have been great for the part. And if he's one of these guys that comes and goes, I want to play that, you go, they just hate him, wouldn't they? So the fact that you're going, can I do that as well? You just go, oh, okay, he's actually rather sweet. And so we were working with our Bottom along that route, you know, and it pays dividends. You know, you get comedy out of some stuff there.
Well, and who doesn't love a cuddly Bottom?
Well, hurrah.
Indeed.
Leaning into the carry-on flavour of our production. Yes, absolutely.
Hey, hello. I'm Adrian Scarborough from TV's Gavin and Stacey, and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Lucky you.
Where can you RSC? The RSC... This fall of 2024, we'll be performing the special election edition of The Complete History of America Abridged in Illinois, Maryland, Virginia, Kentucky, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Colorado. Check out the touring page at our website, ReducedShakespeare.com, or our social media pages for venue and ticket information. Now back to my conversation with Gary Andrews, whose production of A Midsummer Night's Dream runs at the Archway Theatre in England for two more weekends, closing on June 30th, 2024.
You and I both know that a director's work is never done, but in this case, your director, you, the director, have had to take on a role now as you careen towards your opening?
Yeah, 3 weeks before opening, we get an 8-week rehearsal schedule, but it's part time. It's all community, so we're not eight weeks full time. Lovely as that would be, it's an 8 weeks, two evenings a week, and a couple of afternoons on a Sunday. So we've got 3 weeks to go. So we've got literally five rehearsals left, I think it is, something like that, or five times through. I think it's eight rehearsals, but about five hits everything left. And bless him, my Bottom is very poorly and had to drop out. So. Our theatre is quite overstretched at the moment with other shows for casting. So I've just stepped in to take over Bottom. The lines are familiar. I've directed the play enough times. I've never played Bottom. I say Puck three times. If it was Puck, I could have gone on tonight. But I do have to learn them. So, but learning them is kind of like going, oh, I remember. It's more like remembering than learning. So I'm working on that. And it's been an interesting thing because we've worked for like 5 weeks with our lovely actor who was playing it before. And we developed this beautiful, cuddly, warm character. And he's got this incredible, mellifluous, beautiful voice that was just feeding him beautifully to that version, and a physicality that was, you know, sort of bigger than mine, if you like, that was really working. And so I want to honour what he was doing, not start over. So we're trying to keep that thing. So what I've found is, because my voice is tighter and harsher than his, but if I play him, dig back into my heritage and play him Welsh, suddenly he gains this rather sweet, cuddly personality. So, oh, let me play the lion too. You know? I will aggravate my voice. So I will, you know, and it got these lovely words that you can bounce out in the Welsh accent. And suddenly he becomes this eager puppy. So that I've sort of, he wasn't doing it Welsh, I am, but we've got the same character behind it, which is kind of nice.
I love how a version of a character is expressed different ways by different actors using the skills that they're in their toolbox.
The last bottom I had was female. I had a female bottom in that, and she was one of these people with funny bones who was just, and she played her like a sort of jolly hockey stick. Oh, I say, I'm fantastic, and played her like that, and it was brilliant. The time before that, when I had it a youth version, he almost played him like Bertie Wooster. I've had all these different versions, and this one, it's just, I say, as I've ended up playing it, but we're going for this warm, cuddly, over-eager, big puppy, really.
Well, and it's one of the reasons why the play gets done so much. It is available to all these different interpretations, and it means something different every time.
And what I love again with it is you can tweak and nudge it a little bit sometimes. Like for this version, and I have to admit it's something I saw a production recently where they did something along these lines. I went, ooh, that's clever. I don't know about you, but I often find that when you get to the play within a play at the end, you've had so much comedy, and then you've got the play within a play, which sometimes can just fall flat.
Right.
And within the writing, you've got the bit where Quince comes on, tells you what they're going to do, brings everybody on, they dumb show the whole play, and then they do it all again.
Right.
And they act it out and you go, God blimey, how many, it's got more endings than Return of the King, you know, and you go, maybe something we can do. And then I saw this version recently where they took the text that Quince uses when Quince describes the dumb show and split it up to introduce each character coming on in their bit where they act it out.
Mm-hmm.
This man is Pyramus, if you would know, blah, blah, blah. And then Pyramus does his bit. And then here comes Thisbe, and Thisbe does her bit. So it interspersed it, and it just moved it along. Right. And I thought, I'm nicking that. And it's working beautifully. It does just keep the play within the play going along. And we've decided to play that pretty straight. We haven't done any bells and whistles. They are just super keen and letting the comedy that's in the writing do its thing. There's a couple of little visual gags with the walls chink, which don't really work for a podcast. They're visual, they're quite funny. But and again, it's just nice to find different things. I think the last couple of times I've done it, I've had the bit where Pyramus is all bombastic and then Thisbe's speech is really serious and beautifully done and makes everyone go, oh, we feel quite guilty about being rude. But I've done that now two or three times. And I decided, let's just have Thisbe, taking the hint from earlier where Quince says, you speak all your part at once, cues and all. So I've literally, when Thisbe comes on after Pyramus is dead, just literally delivers that speech like a bullet. The whole speech, including she stabs herself. She says the cue. So, you know, blah, 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 she stabs herself, so I die, dies. And says everything.
Lovely. Lovely. No, that's great. And I love, that is sincere and heartfelt too, in its way, you know, taking your cue from the text and playing it straight. I love a dream where the lovers are funnier than you expect and the mechanicals are more grounded and genuine and emotional than you expect. That's lovely surprise and contrast.
Yeah. It's and I've got a lovely set of actors playing it who are just sort of going beautifully falling into their roles. Our Quince is female and she's like a sort of older Mary Poppins, very sort of quite prim and posh with a little straw boater and sort of making all these work. It's almost like she's the Sunday school teacher who's also got a little amateur dramatic society on the side, you know. And we do have one little gag we've put in where no one can remember Snug's name. Every time Snug comes in, he introduces himself to everybody. Snug, 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 Snug. But every time they mention him, they go, and he goes, Snug, Snug. And they remember. And then when he says he's the lion at the end and he does his speech, he forgets his own name and they have to prompt him who he is. So that's a little
Beautiful. I love like that.
You know, that's us having fun. But it is incredible how it does keep rewarding, that you just keep finding all this new stuff. Maybe it won't be my last. I might come back to it again. Who knows?
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Comedy Podcast, except for one more thing, which I'll share with you in about 60 seconds, so stick around. Gary Andrews' Archway Theatre production of A Midsummer Night's Dream runs at the Wakehurst Place Gardens in England for two more weekends, closing on June 30th, 2024. Go to archwaytheatre.co.uk for more information. Then send us your dreamed dreams via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com or throw a comment to us over on the socials or on our own actual website, reducedshakespeare.com, or visit my website, theshakespeareans.com. You can also follow Gary on most of the socials at Gary Scribbler. Thanks, as always, to No Pucks Left to Give Matthew Croak, web services by Ginger Power Limited, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Mr. K. Wynn. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Adrian Scarborough. And as always, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 915 2745ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
Is there another Shakespeare play that you have done as much or would like to do again as much?
I've done Twelfth Night three or four times, I think, and I would love to do that again. I know that at our little theatre, someone is going to do it next year, I believe, so I will be auditioning. I've been Feste twice, I've directed it, and I've been Malvolio. So I would happily do any of those again. I would love to, but I also really fancy having a crack at Toby Belch.
I would imagine, yeah.
Really interesting part. It's kind of like an embryonic Falstaff.
Yep.
You see echoes of that in there, and you go, oh, it's kind of like an alternative Falstaff. Again, there's so many ways, depending on how people said it, how to play that part, and rather than just a boorish drunk, I'm sure there's other stuff that worth mining. So that one would be great. That's probably the one that comes next, I think, for me in terms of ones I've done.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.